for cold bottle of red cap, please. No beer for sale on Sunday, the man said. He was a light-skinned Negro with red hair turning white. Oh, I forgot what day it was. Milkman smiled. Pop, then. I mean soda. Got any on ice? Cherry smash. That suit you? Fine, suit me fine. The man walked over to the side of the store and slid open the door of an ancient cooler. The floor was worn and wavy with years of footsteps. Cans of goods on the shelf were sparse, but the sacks, trays, and cartons of perishables and semi-perishables were plentiful. The man pulled a bottle of red liquid from the cooler and wiped it dry on his apron before handing it to Milkman. A nickel if you drink it here, 7 cents if you don't. I'll drink it here. Just get in? Yeah, car broke down. Is there a garage nearby? No, 5 miles yonder is one, though. 5 miles? Yep. What's the trouble? Maybe one of us can fix it. Where you headed? Shalimar. You standing in it? Right here? This is Shalimar? Yes, sir. Shalimon. The man pronounced it Shalimon. Good thing I broke down. I would have missed it for sure. Milkman laughed. Your friend almost missed it, too. My friend? What friend? The one looking for you. Drove in here early this morning and asked for you. Asked for me by name? No, he never mentioned your name. Then how do you know he was looking for me? Said he was looking for his friend in a 3-piece beige suit, like that. He pointed to Milkman's chest. What'd he look like? Dark-skinned man, about your complexion. Tall, thin. What's the matter? Y'all get your wires crossed? Yeah, no. I mean, what was his name? Didn't say. Just asked for you. He come a long way to meet you, though. I know that. Drove a Ford with Michigan tags. Michigan? You sure Michigan? Sure, I'm sure. Was he supposed to meet you in Roanoke? When Milkman looked wild-eyed, the man said, I seen your tags. Milkman sighed with relief, and then said, I wasn't sure where we were going to meet up, and he didn't say his name? No, just said to give you some good luck message if I was to see you. Let me see. Good luck? Yeah, said to tell you your day was sure coming, or your day, something like that. Your day is here. But I know it had a day in it. But I ain't sure if he said it was coming or was already here. He chuckled. Wish mine was here. Been waiting 57 years, and it ain't come yet. The other men in the store laughed congenially, while Milkman stood frozen, everything in him quiet, but his heart. There was no mistaking the message or the messenger. Guitar was looking for him, was following him, and for professional reasons. Unless, would Guitar joke about that phrase? That special secret word the 7 days whispered to their victims? The drink abuse you? Mr. Solomon was looking at him. Sweet soda water don't agree with me. Milkman shook his head and swallowed the rest hurriedly. No, he said, I'm just car weary. I think I'll sit outside a while. He started toward the door. You want me to see about your car for you? Mr. Solomon sounded slightly offended. In a minute. I'll be right back. Milkman pushed the screen door and stepped outside on the porch. The sun was blazing. He took off his jacket and held it on his forefinger over his shoulder. He gazed up and down the dusty road, shotgun houses with wide spaces between them, a few dogs, chickens, children, and the women with nothing in their hands. They sat on porches and walked in the road, swaying their hips under cotton dresses, bare-legged, their unstraightened hair braided or pulled straight back into a ball. He wanted one of them bad, to curl up in a cot in that one's arms, or that one, or that. That's the way Pilate must have looked as a girl, looked even now, but out of place in the big northern city she had come to. Wide, sleepy eyes that tilted up at the corners, high cheekbones, full lips blacker than their skin, berry-stained, and long, long necks. There must be a lot of intermarriage in this place, he thought. All the women looked alike, and except for some light-skinned, red-headed men like Mr. Solomon, the men looked very much like the women. Visitors to Shalimar must be rare, and new blood that settled here non-existent. Milkman stepped off the porch, scattering the hens, and walked down the road toward a clump of trees near a building that looked like a church or clubhouse of some sort. Children were playing behind the trees. Spreading his jacket on the burnt grass, he sat down and lit a cigarette. Guitar was here, had asked for him. But why was he afraid? They were friends, close friends, so close he had told him all about the 7 days. There was no trust heavier than that. Milkman was a confidant, almost an accomplice, so why was he afraid? It was senseless. Guitar must have left that particular message so Milkman could know who was looking for him without giving his name. Something must have happened back home. Guitar must be running, from the police maybe, and decided to run toward his friend, the only one, other than the days, who would know what it was all about and whom he could trust. Guitar needed to find Milkman, and he needed help. That was it. But if Guitar knew Milkman was headed for Shalimar, he must have found that out in Roanoke, or Culpeper, or maybe even in Danville. And if he knew that, why didn't he wait? Where was he now? Trouble. Guitar was in trouble. Behind him, the children were singing a kind of Ring Around the Rosie or Little Sally Walker game. Milkman turned to watch. About 8 or 9 boys and girls were standing in a circle, a boy in the middle, his arms outstretched, turned around like an airplane, while the others sang some meaningless rhyme. Jay, the only son of Solomon, come Bubiale, come Bubatambi, whirl about and touch the sun, come Bubiale, come Bubatambi. They went on with several verses, the boy in the middle doing his imitation of an airplane. The climax of the game was a rapid shouting of nonsense words, accompanied by more rapid twirling. Solomon Rai Balishu, Yaruba Madani Hamlet too, until the last line. 21 children, the last one Jay. At which point, the boy crashed to earth and the others screamed. Milkman watched the children. He never played like that as a child. As soon as he got up off his knees at the windowsill, grieving because he could not fly and went off to school, his velvet suit separated him from the other children. White and black thought he was a riot and went out of their way to laugh at him and see to it that he had no lunch to eat, nor any crayons, nor ever got through the line to the toilet or the water fountain. His mother finally surrendered to his begging for corduroy knickers or straights, which helped a little, but he was never asked to play those circle games, those singing games, to join in anything until Guitar pulled those four boys off him. Milkman smiled, remembering how Guitar grinned and whooped as the four boys turned on him. It was the first time Milkman saw anybody really enjoy a fight. Afterward, Guitar had taken off his baseball cap and handed it to Milkman, telling him to wipe the blood from his nose. Milkman bloodied the cap, returned it, and Guitar slapped it back on his head. Remembering those days now, Milkman was ashamed of having been frightened or suspicious of Guitar's message. When he turned up, he would explain everything, and Milkman would do what he could to help. He stood up and brushed his jacket. A black rooster strutted by, its blood-red comb draped forward like a wicked brow. Milkman walked back toward Solomon's store. He needed a place to stay, some information, and a woman, not necessarily in that order. He would begin wherever the beginning was. In a way, it was good Guitar had asked for him. Along with waiting for him and waiting for some way to get a new fan belt, he had a legitimate reason to dawdle. Hens and cats gave up their places on the steps as he approached them. "Feeling better, are you?" asked Mr. Solomon. "Much better. Just needed a stretch, I guess." He jutted his chin toward the window. "Nice around here. Peaceful. Pretty women, too." A young man, sitting on a chair, tilted to the wall, pushed his hat back from his forehead and let the front legs of the chair hit the floor. His lips were open, exposing the absence of four front teeth. The other men moved their feet. Mr. Solomon smiled, but didn't say anything. Milkman sensed that he'd struck a wrong note about the women, he guessed. What kind of place was this, where a man couldn't even ask for a woman? He changed the subject. "If my friend, the one who stopped by this morning, was going to wait for me here, where would he be likely to find a place to stay? Any rooming houses around here?" "Rooming houses?" "Yeah, where a man can spend the night." Mr. Solomon shook his head. "Nothing like that here." Milkman was getting annoyed. What was all the hostility for? He looked at the men sitting around the store. "You think maybe one of them could help with the car?" he asked Mr. Solomon. "Maybe get another belt somewhere?" Mr. Solomon kept his eyes on the counter. "Guess I could ask him." His voice was soft. He spoke as if he was embarrassed about something. There was none of the earlier chattiness he'd been full of when Milkman arrived. "If they can't find one, let me know right away. I may have to buy another car to get back home." Every one of the faces of the men turned to look at him, and Milkman knew he had said something else wrong, although he didn't know what. He only knew that they behaved as if they'd been insulted. In fact, they had been. They looked with hatred at the city Negro, who could buy a car as if it were a bottle of whiskey because the one he had was broken. And what's more, who had said so in front of them. He hadn't bothered to say his name nor ask theirs, had called them, and would certainly despise their days, which should have been spent harvesting their own crops instead of waiting around the general store hoping a truck would come looking for mill hands or tobacco pickers in the flatlands that belonged to somebody else. His manner, his clothes, were reminders that they had no crops of their own and no land to speak of either, just vegetable gardens which the women took care of, and chickens and pigs that the children took care of. He was telling them that they weren't men, that they relied on women and children for their food, and that the lint and tobacco in their pants pockets, where dollar bills should have been, was the measure. That thin shoes and suits with vests and smooth, smooth hands were the measure. That eyes that had seen big cities and the inside of airplanes were the measure. They had seen him watching their women and rubbing his fly as he stood on the steps. They had also seen him lock his car as soon as he got out of it, in a place where there couldn't be more than two keys 25 miles around. He hadn't found them fit enough or good enough to want to know their names, and believed himself too good to tell them his. They looked at his skin and saw it was as black as theirs, but they knew he had the heart of the white men who came to pick them up in the trucks when they needed anonymous, faceless laborers. Now one of them spoke to the Negro with the Virginia license and the northern accent. "Big money up north, huh?"
"Some," Milkman answered.
"Some. I hear tell everybody up north got big money."
"A lot of people up north got nothing."
Milkman made his voice pleasant, but he knew something was developing.
"It's hard to believe. Why would anybody want to stay there if there ain't no big money?"
"The sights, I guess," another man answered the first.
"The sights and the women."
"You kidding," said the first man in mock dismay.
"You mean to tell me pussy different up north?"
"No," said the second. "Pussy the same everywhere. Smell like the ocean, taste like the sea."
"Can't be," said a third. "Gotta be different."
"Maybe the pricks is different," the first man spoke again.
"Reckon?" asked the second man.
"So I hear tell," said the first man.
"How different?"
asked the second man.
"Wee little," said the first man. "Wee, wee little."
"No," said the second man.
"So they tell me.
That's why they pant so tight."
"That true?"
The first man looked at Milkman for an answer.
"I wouldn't know," said Milkman. "I never spent much time smacking my lips over another man's dick."
Everybody smiled, including Milkman. It was about to begin.
"What about his asshole? Ever smack your lips over that?"
"Once," said Milkman, "when a little young nigger made me mad and I had to jam a Coke bottle up his ass."
"What'd you use a Coke bottle for? Your cock wouldn't fill it?"
"It did. After I took the Coke bottle out, filled his mouth, too."
"Prefer mouth to you? If it's big enough and ugly enough and belongs to an ignorant motherfucker who's about to get the living shit whipped out of him."
The knife glittered.
Milkman laughed. "I ain't seen one of those since I was 14. Where I come from, boys play with knives. If they scared they gonna lose, that is."
The first man smiled. "That's me, motherfucker. Scared to death I'm gonna lose." Milkman did the best he could with a broken bottle, but his face got slit, and so did his left hand, and so did his pretty beige suit, and he probably would have had his throat cut if two women hadn't come running in screaming, "Saul! Saul!" The store was full of people by then, and the women couldn't get through. The men tried to shush them, but they kept on screaming and provided enough lull for Mr. Solomon to interrupt the fight.
"All right, all right. That's enough of that."
"Shut your mouth, Solomon. Get the women out of here."
"Stick him, Saul. Stick that cocksucker."
But Saul had a jagged cut over his eye, and the blood pouring from it made it hard to see. It was difficult, but not impossible, for Mr. Solomon to pull him away. He left cursing Milkman, but his fervor was gone. Milkman backed up against the counter, waiting to see if anybody else was going to jump him.
when it looked as if no one was, and when the people were drifting outside to watch Saul scuffling and cursing at the men pulling him away, he slumped a little and wiped his face. When the entire store, save for the owner, was empty, Milkman hurled a broken bottle into a corner. It careened by the cooler and bounced off the wall before splintering on the floor. He walked outside, still panting, and looked around. Four older men still sat on the porch as though nothing had happened. Blood was streaming down Milkman's face, but it had dried on his hand. He kicked at a white hen and sat down on the top step, wiping the blood with his handkerchief. Three young women, with nothing in their hands, stood in the road looking at him. Their eyes were wide, but noncommittal. Children joined them, circling the women like birds. Nobody said anything. Even the four men on the porch were quiet. Nobody came toward him, offered him a cigarette or a glass of water. Only the children and the hens walked around. Under the hot sun, Milkman was frozen with anger. If he'd had a weapon, he would have slaughtered everybody in sight. "You pretty good with a bottle. How are you with a shotgun?" One of the older men had sidled up to him. The smile on his face was faint. It was as though now that the young men had had their chance, with unsatisfactory results, the older men would take over. Their style, of course, would be different. No name-calling toilet contest for them, no knives either, no hot breath and knotted neck muscles. They would test him, match and beat him, probably, on some other ground. "Best shot there is," Milkman lied. "That so?" "Yeah, it's so. Some of us is going hunting later. Care to join us?" "That toothless motherfucker going too?" "Saul? No. 'Cause I might have to knock the rest of them out." The man laughed. "Sheriff took the others with the butt of a gun." "Yeah? Good. Well, you coming?" "Sure I'm coming. Just get me the gun." He laughed again. "Name's Omar. Macon Dead." Omar blinked at the name, but didn't comment on it. He merely told him to come by King Walker's, a gas station about 2 miles up the road, right around sundown. "It's straight up yonder. Ain't no way in the world you can miss it." "I won't miss it." Milkman stood up and walked to his car. He fumbled for the car keys, opened the door, and slid into the seat. He rolled down all four windows, found a towel in the back seat, and stretched out, using his jacket for a pillow and the towel as a bandage for his face. His feet stuck out the open door. Fuck 'em. Who were all these people roaming the world trying to kill him? His own father had tried while he was still in his mother's stomach, but he lived. And he had lived the last year dodging a woman who came every month to kill him. And he had lain just like this, with his arm over his eyes, wide open to whatever she had in her hand. He'd lived through that, too. Then a witch had stepped out of his childhood nightmares to grab him, and he lived through that. Some bats had driven him out of a cave, and he lived through that. And at no time did he have a weapon. Now he walked into a store and asked if somebody could fix his car, and a nigger pulled a knife on him. And he still wasn't dead. Now what did these black Neanderthals think they were going to do? "Fuck 'em, my name's Macon. I'm already dead." He had thought this place, this Shalimar, was going to be home, his original home. His people came from here, his grandfather and his grandmother. All the way down south, people had been nice to him, generous, helpful. and Danville that made him the object of hero worship. In his own hometown, his name spelled dread and grudging respect. But here, in his home, he was unknown, unloved, and damn near killed. These were some of the meanest unhung niggers in the world. He slept, unmolested by everything and everybody, except a dream in which he thought he saw Guitar looking down on him. When he woke, he bought 2 cans of pineapple and a box of crackers from Mr. Solomon. He ate on the porch with the hens. The men were gone, and the sun was leaving. Only the children stayed to watch him eat. When he poured the last of the pineapple juice down his throat, one of the children stepped forward to ask, "Can we have your can, mister?" He held it out, and they snatched the can and ran off to fashion some game out of it. He started out for King Walker's. Even if he could have come up with a way to get out of the hunt, he wouldn't have taken it, in spite of the fact that he had never handled a firearm in his life. He had stopped evading things, sliding through, over, and around difficulties. Before, he had taken risks only with Guitar. Now he took them alone. Not only had he let Hager stab him, he had let the Nightmare Witch catch him and kiss him. To a man surviving that, anything else was a joke. King Walker was nothing like his name suggested. He was a small man, bald, with the left cheek bulging with tobacco. Years ago, he'd been a star pitcher in one of the black baseball leagues, and the history of his career was nailed and pasted all over his shop. They had not lied when they said no garage or mechanic on duty was nearer than 5 miles. King Walker Station had obviously gone broke a long time ago. The pumps were dry. There wasn't even a can of oil in the place. Now it seemed to be used as a kind of clubhouse for the men, and Walker lived in the back of the station. In addition to King Walker, who wasn't going, there was Omar and another man who had also been on the porch and who introduced himself as Luther Solomon, no relation to the grocery store Solomon. They were waiting for some others, who came soon after Milkman got there, driving an old Chevy. Omar introduced them as Calvin Breakstone and Small Boy. Calvin seemed to be the most congenial of them, and followed the introductions with a command to King Walker to get this city boy some shoes for his feet. King rummaged around, spitting tobacco, and came up with some mud-cake brogans. They outfitted Milkman completely, laughing all the while at his underwear, fingering his vest. Small Boy tried to get his wrestler's arms into Milkman's jacket and wondering what had happened to his feet. Bits of skin still peeled from his toes because of the 2 days he had spent in wet shoes and socks. King Walker made him sprinkle Arm & Hammer soda on them before he put on the thick socks they gave him. When Milkman was dressed in World War II army fatigues with a knit cap on his head, they opened some Falstaff beer and began to talk about guns, at which point the revelry mixed with meanness abated, and King Walker handed Milkman his Winchester 22. "Ever use a 22? "Not in a good while," Milkman said. The 5 men piled into the Chevy and drove off into the lessening light. From what Milkman could tell, after 15 minutes or so, they were going up to high ground. As the car swerved through narrow roads, the conversation picked up again, and they talked about other trips, game, kills, Mrs. Soon, the only light came from the moon, and it was getting cool enough for Milkman to be grateful for his knit cap. The car pulled ahead and around some sharp bends. In the rear-view mirror, Milkman thought he glimpsed the headlights of another car and wondered briefly if they were being met by others. The sky was dark enough now for stars. Better make time, Calvin. Coon be done eight and gone on home. Calvin pulled over and stopped the car. Let him rip, he said, and handed the car keys to small boy, who walked around to the back and unlocked the trunk. Three hounds leaped out, sniffing and wagging their tails, but they didn't make a sound. You brought Becky? Asked Luther. Oh, man, we're gonna get some coon tonight. The dogs' nervousness, their eagerness to hear the signal that would allow them to race off into the trees, made Milkman jittery. What was he supposed to do? 2 feet in any direction from the headlights was black night. Omar and Smallboy hauled equipment from the trunk, 4 lamps, 1 flashlight, rope, shells, and a pint bottle of liquor. When all 4 lamps were ablaze, they asked Milkman if he wanted to use a lamp or a flashlight. He hesitated, and Calvin said, "He can run with me. Give him the torch." Milkman put it in his back pocket. "Take that change out your pocket," said Calvin. "Makes too much noise." Milkman did as he was told and took King's shotgun, a piece of rope, and a deep swig from the bottle they were passing around. The dogs padded about, silent, panting, almost faint with excitement, but still they made no sound. Calvin and Omar both loaded their double-gauge shotguns with 22 shells in one barrel and buckshot in the other. Small boy clapped his hands once, and the 3 hounds sped screaming into the night. The men didn't take off after them at once, as Milkman had supposed they would. Instead, they stood quietly and listened for a while. Small boy laughed lightly, shaking his head. "Becky's leading. Let's go. Calvin, you and Macon go off to the right. We'll head this way and circle over by the gulch. Don't shoot no bears now." "Shoot him if I see him," said Calvin, as he and Milkman moved away. After they left the Chevy, the car that Milkman had noticed sped past them. Obviously, there were no others in the hunting party. Calvin was ahead, the burning lamp swinging low from his hand. Milkman flicked on his flashlight. "Better save it," said Calvin. "You don't need it now." He plodded on in a direction that may have been toward the screaming dogs, but Milkman couldn't tell. "Any bears out here?" he asked, in what he hoped was an interested but not anxious voice. "Just us, and we got the guns." Calvin laughed and was suddenly swallowed up by the dark, only the low swinging lamp marking his path. Milkman watched the lamp until he realized that focusing on it kept him from seeing anything else. If he was to grow accustomed to the dark, he would have to look at what it was possible to see. A long moan sailed up through the trees somewhere to the left of where they were. It sounded like a woman's voice, sobbing and mingling with the dog's yelps and the man's shouts. A few minutes later, the distant screaming of the dogs and the calls of the 3 men stopped. There was only the soughing wind and his and Calvin's footsteps. It took Milkman a while to figure out how to pick up his feet and miss the roots and stones, to distinguish a tree from a shadow, to keep his head down and away from the branches that swept back up from Calvin's hand into his face. They were walking upland. Every now and then, Calvin stopped, threw his lamplight on a tree, and examined it closely, from about 3 feet off the ground, to up as far as his arm could go. Other times, he lowered the lamp over the ground, and squatting down on his haunches, peered into the dirt. Each time, he seemed to be whispering. Whatever he discovered, he kept to himself, and Milkman didn't ask him. All he wanted to do was keep up, be ready to shoot whatever the game was when it appeared, and look out for an attempt any of them might make on his life. Within an hour after arriving in Shalimar, a young man had tried to kill him in public. What these older men, under cover of night, were capable of, he could only guess. He heard the sound of the sobbing woman again and asked Calvin, "What the hell is that?" "Echo," he said. "Reiner's Gulch is up ahead. It makes that sound when the wind hits a certain way." "Sounds like a woman crying," said Milkman. "Reiner. Folks say a woman named Reiner is crying in there. That's how it got the name." Calvin stopped, but so suddenly that Milkman, deep in thought about Reiner, bumped into him. "Hush." Calvin closed his eyes and tilted his head into the wind. All Milkman could hear was the dogs again, yelping, but more rapidly, he thought, than before. Calvin whistled. A faint whistle came back to them. "Son of a fucking bitch," Calvin's voice broke with agitation. "Bobcat, come on, man." He literally sprang away, and Milkman did the same. Now they moved at double time, still on land that sloped upward. It was the longest trek Milkman had ever made in his life. Miles, he thought. We must be covering miles. And hours. It must be 2 hours now since he whistled. On they walked, and Calvin never broke his stride for anything except an occasional shout and an occasional pause to listen to the sound that came back. The light was changing, and Milkman was getting very tired. The distance between himself and Calvin's lamp was getting wider and wider. He was 20 years younger than Calvin, but found himself unable to keep up the pace. And he was getting clumsy, stepping over big stones rather than around them, dragging his feet and catching them in humped roots. And now that Calvin was not directly in front, he had to push the branches away from his face himself. The doubling down and under branches and pushing things out of the way were as exhausting as the walk. His breath was coming in shorter and shorter gasps, and he wanted to sit down more than anything in the world. He believed they were circling now, for it seemed to him that this was the third time he had seen that double-humped rock in the distance. Should they be circling, he wondered. Then he thought he remembered hearing that certain prey circled when it was being stalked. Did bobcat? He didn't even know what a bobcat looked like. At last, he surrendered to his fatigue and made the mistake of sitting down instead of slowing down. For when he got up again, the rest had given his feet an opportunity to hurt him, and the pain in his short leg was so great he began to limp and hobble. Soon it was impossible for him to walk longer than 5 minutes at a time without pausing to lean against a sweet gum tree. Calvin was a pinpoint of light, bobbing ahead in and out of the trees. Finally, Milkman could take no more. He had to rest. At the next tree, he sank down to the ground and put his head back on its bark. Let them laugh if they wanted to. He would not move until his heart left from under his chin and went back down into his chest. where it belonged. He spread his legs, pulled the flashlight out of his hip pocket, and put his Winchester down near his right leg. At rest now, he could feel the blood pulsing in his temple and the cut on his face stinging in the night wind from the leaf juice and tree sap the branches had smeared on it. When he was breathing almost normally, he began to wonder what he was doing, sitting in the middle of a woods in Blue Ridge Country. He had come here to find traces of Pilot's journey, to find relatives she might have visited, to find anything he could that would either lead him to the gold or convince him that it no longer existed. How had he got himself involved in a hunt, involved in a knife-and-broken-bottle fight in the first place? Ignorance, he thought, and vanity. He hadn't been alert early enough, hadn't seen the signs jutting out everywhere around him. Maybe this was a mean bunch of black folk. But he should have guessed it, sensed it. And part of the reason he hadn't was the easy, good treatment he had received elsewhere. Or had he? Maybe the glow of hero worship, twice removed, that had bathed him in Danville, had also blinded him. Perhaps the eyes of the men in Roanoke, Petersburg, Newport News, had not been bright with welcome and admiration. Maybe they were just curious. Or amused. He hadn't stayed in any place long enough to find out. A meal here, gas there. The one real contact was the buying of the car. And the seller, needing a buyer, would naturally be friendly under those circumstances. The same thing held when he'd had to have those elaborate repairs. What kind of savages were these people? Suspicious. Hot-tempered, eager to find fault, and despise any outsider. Touchy, devious, jealous, traitorous, and evil. He had done nothing to deserve their contempt, nothing to deserve the explosive hostility that engulfed him when he said he might have to buy a car. Why didn't they respond the way the man in Roanoke did when he bought the car? Because in Roanoke, he did not have a car. Here he had one and wanted another, and perhaps it was that upset them. Furthermore, he hadn't even suggested that he would trade the old one in. He had hinted that he would abandon the broken one and just get another. But so what? What business was it of theirs, what he did with his money? He didn't deserve... It sounded old, deserved, old and tired and beaten to death, deserve. Now it seemed to him that he was always saying or thinking that he didn't deserve some bad luck or some bad treatment from others. He told Guitar that he didn't deserve his family's dependence, hatred, or whatever. That he didn't even deserve to hear all the misery and mutual accusations his parents unloaded on him. Nor did he deserve Hager's vengeance. But why shouldn't his parents tell him their personal problems? If not him, then who? And if a stranger could try to kill him, surely Hager, who knew him, and whom he'd thrown away like a wad of chewing gum after the flavor was gone, she had a right to try to kill him too. Apparently he thought he deserved only to be loved, from a distance though, and given what he wanted. And in return he would be, what, pleasant? Generous? Maybe all he was really saying was, I am not responsible for your pain. Share your happiness with me, but not your unhappiness. They were troublesome thoughts, but they wouldn't go away. Under the moon, on the ground, alone, with not even the sound of baying dogs to remind him that he was with other people, Hisself, the cocoon that was personality, gave way. He could barely see his own hand and couldn't see his feet. He was only his breath, coming slower now, and his thoughts. The rest of him had disappeared. So the thoughts came unobstructed by other people, by things, even by the sight of himself. There was nothing here to help him. Not his money, his car, his father's reputation, his suit, or his shoes. In fact, they hampered him. Except for his broken watch and his wallet with about $200, all he had started out with on his journey was gone. His suitcase with scotch, the shirts, and the space for bags of gold, his snap-brim hat, his tie, his shirt, his three-piece suit, his socks, and his shoes. His watch and his $200 would be of no help out here, where all a man had was what he was born with or had learned to use. And endurance. Eyes, ears, nose, taste, touch, and some other sense that he knew he did not have. An ability to separate out of all the things there were to sense, the one that life itself might depend on. What did Calvin see on the bark, on the ground? What was he saying? What did he hear that made him know something unexpected had happened, some 2 miles, perhaps more, away, and that something was a different kind of prey, a bobcat? He could still hear them, the way they had sounded the last few hours, signaling one another. What were they saying? Wait up? Over here? Little by little, it fell into place. The dogs, the men, none was just hollering, just signaling location or pace. The men and the dogs were talking to each other in distinctive voices. They were saying distinctive, complicated things. That long yah sound was followed by a specific kind of howl from one of the dogs. The low hum, hum that sounded like a string bass imitating a bassoon meant something the dogs understood and executed. And the dogs spoke to the men. Single-shot barks, evenly spaced and widely spaced. One every 3 or 4 minutes. That might go on for 20 minutes. A sort of radar that indicated to the men where they were and what they saw and what they wanted to do about it. And the men agreed or told them to change direction or to come back. All those shrieks, those rapid tumbling barks, the long sustained yells, the tuba sounds, the drumbeat sounds, the low, liquid hum, hum, the reedy whistles, the thin ease of a cornet, the bass chords. It was all language, an extension of the click people made in their cheeks back home when they wanted a dog to follow them. No, it was not language. It was what there was before language, before things were written down. Language in the time when men and animals did talk to one another, when a man could sit down with an ape and the two converse, when a tiger and a man could share the same tree and each understood the other, when men ran with wolves, not from or after them. And he was hearing it in the Blue Ridge Mountains under a sweet gum tree. And if they could talk to animals, and the animals could talk to them, what didn't they know about human beings, or the earth itself, for that matter? It was more than tracks Calvin was looking for. He whispered to the trees, whispered to the ground, touched them, as a blind man caresses a page of Braille, pulling meaning through his fingers. Milkman rubbed the back of his head against the bark. This was what Qatar had missed about the South. The woods, hunters, killing. But something had maimed him, scarred him like Reverend Cooper's knot, like Saul's missing teeth, and like his own father. He felt a sudden rush of affection for them all. And out there, under the sweet gum tree, within the sound of men tracking a bobcat, he thought he understood Qatar now, really understood him. Down either side of his thighs, he felt the sweet gum surface roots cradling him like the rough but maternal hands of a grandfather. Feeling both tense and relaxed, he sank his fingers into the grass. He tried to listen with his fingertips to hear what, if anything, the earth had to say, and it told him quickly that someone was standing behind him, and he had just enough time to raise one hand to his neck and catch the wire that fastened around his throat. It cut like a razor into his fingers, tore into the skin so deeply he had to let go. The wire pressed into his neck then and took his breath. He thought he heard himself gurgling and saw a burst of many-colored lights dancing before his eyes. When the music followed the colored lights, he knew he had just drawn the last sweet air left for him in the world, exactly the way he'd heard it would be. His life flashed before him, but it consisted of only one image, Hagar bending over him in perfect love, in the most intimate sexual gesture imaginable. In the midst of that picture, he heard the voice of the someone holding the wire say, "Your day has come," and it filled him with such sadness to be dying, leaving this world at the fingertips of his friend, that he relaxed. And in the instant it took to surrender to the overwhelming melancholy, he felt the cords of his struggling neck muscles relax too, and there was a piece of a second in which the wire left him room enough to gasp, to take another breath. But it was a living breath this time, not a dying one. Hagar, the lights, the music disappeared, and Milkman grabbed the Winchester at his side, cocked it, and pulled the trigger, shooting into the trees in front of him. The blast startled Qatar, and the wire slipped again. Qatar pulled it back, but Milkman knew his friend would need both hands to keep it that way. He turned the shotgun backward as far as he could and managed awkwardly to pull the trigger again, hitting only branches and dirt. He was wondering if there was another blast in the gun when he heard right up close the wild, wonderful sound of three baying dogs who he knew had treed a bobcat. The wire dropped, and he heard Qatar breaking into a fast run through the trees. Milkman stood up and grabbed his flashlight, pointing it in the direction of the sound of running feet. He saw nothing but branches resettling themselves. Rubbing his neck, he moved toward the sound of the dogs. Qatar did not have a gun, otherwise he would have used it. So Milkman felt secure heading for the dogs with the gun in his hand, even though it had no more shot. He didn't miss. His sense of direction was accurate, and he came upon Calvin, small boy Luther, and Omar crouching on the ground a few feet away from the dogs and the glistening night eyes of a bobcat in a tree. The dogs were trying their best to get up into the tree, and the men were considering whether to shoot the bobcat down, shoot a limb, and make him jump down and fight the dogs, or what. They decided to try and kill the cat where he lay. Omar stood up and took his lamp over to the left. The cat crept a little ways out, following the light. Then Small Boy took aim and put a bullet just under the left foreleg, and the bobcat dropped through the branches into the jaws of Becky and her companions. There was a lot of life in the cat. He fought well until Calvin hollered the dogs away and shot it again and once more, and then it was still. They held the lamps over the carcass and groaned with pleasure at the size, the ferocity, the stillness of it. All four got down on their knees, pulling rope and knives, cutting a branch the width of a wrist, tying it and binding it for the long walk back. They were so pleased with themselves, it was some time before anybody remembered to ask Milkman what he was shooting at back there. Milkman hoisted the stake he was carrying a little higher and said, "I dropped the gun. I tripped, and it went off. Then, when I picked it up, it went off again." They burst into laughter. "Tripped? What'd you have the safety off for? Was you scared?" "Scared to death," said Milkman. "Scared to death." They hooted and laughed all the way back to the car, teasing Milkman, egging him on to tell more about how scared he was. And he told them, laughing too, hard, loud, and long. Really laughing, and he found himself exhilarated by simply walking the earth, walking it like he belonged on it, like his legs were stalks, tree trunks, a part of his body that extended down, down, down into the rock and soil, and were comfortable there, on the earth and on the place where he walked. And he did not limp. They met Dawn in King Walker's gas station for a rehash of the night they had spent. Milkman was the butt of their humor, but it was good-humored humor, quite unlike the laughter the trip had begun with. "Lucky to be alive. Cat wasn't the problem. This here nigger was the problem, blasting away at us, while we got a mean cat getting ready to chew us and the dogs up both, shooting all through the woods. Could have blown his own head off. Don't you city boys know how to handle yourself?" "You country niggers got it all over us," Milkman answered. Omar and Small Boy slapped him on the shoulders. Calvin hollered to Luther, "Go get Vernell. Tell her to get breakfast ready. Soon's we skin this cat, we coming in there with an appetite, and she better be ready to meet it." Milkman went with them to the back of the station, where on a small, cemented area covered by a corrugated tin roof, the dead bobcat lay. Milkman's neck had swollen, so it was difficult for him to lower his chin without pain. Omar sliced through the rope that bound the bobcat's feet. He and Calvin turned it over on its back. The legs fell open, such thin, delicate ankles. Everybody wants a black man's life. Calvin held the forefeet open and up, while Omar pierced the curling hair at the point where the sternum lay. Then he sliced all the way down to the genitals, his knife pointed upward for a cleaner, neater incision. Not his dead life. I mean his living life. When he reached the genitals, he cut them off, but left the scrotum intact. It's the condition our condition is in. Omar cut around the legs and the neck, then he pulled the hide off. What good is a man's life if he can't even choose what to die for? The transparent underskin tore like gossamer under his fingers. Everybody wants the life of a black man. Now small boy knelt down and slit